Senate Consumer and Business Affairs Committee meeting in room 319 at 3 o'clock p.m. on Monday, May the 26th, to discuss malpractice insurance.
Meeting will come to order. I want to take testimony today, this afternoon, primarily from the lawyers who are represented here today. And this meeting will continue tonight. For the benefit of the committee members, we're all excused from the session at 4 o'clock unless you have a bill to carry. And we'll keep going until 5, and then we'll go down and join them in the session. I haven't had a chance to look at who all has signed up, but I'm going to stick with the lawyers this afternoon until we run out of the lawyers who have signed up, and then we'll go to other people, and we may have to hold you, some of you over until this evening. Okay, Dick Noble, let's go to you first. You were here the other night. We're on 2647, if anybody has to be told.
My name is Dick Noble. I'm a lawyer with the firm of Posey, Wilson & Atchison in Portland. Our office is on the plaintiff's side of the bar. I have had the privilege of representing a number of people who have sought compensation against physicians or hospitals. Or injury suffered as a result of medical negligence. Before commenting on the bill, I want to state that as a result of reviewing literally hundreds of potential medical negligence cases, I've come to the conclusion that the huge majority of physicians in this state are conscientious and are doing an excellent job in extending our life and improving its quality. I know Malcolm Todd said recently on 60 Minutes that approximately 5% of the doctors in the country were incompetent. My own experience and the experience of our office would indicate that in Oregon it's less than 5%. I think that the bill that you have before you that came from the House Judiciary Committee and passed the House, from the testimony of those representatives who were here at the first hearing, it would indicate, I believe, that the House attempted to solve the doctor's insurance problem by limiting the rights of the victims of medical negligence in the hope that if they could sufficiently restrict the victim's rights to decrease his opportunity to obtain a recovery or to limit the recovery if he were successful under restrictive circumstances, then that perhaps that the business would become attractive to the insurance industry and that would solve the problem. From a philosophical standpoint, as well as from the standpoint of the people that I represent, I'm opposed to the approach of giving away the rights of the citizens in order to make the market more attractive for the insurance company. Perhaps it would be helpful to the committee if I went through a little bit about how a medical malpractice case is handled from the plaintiff's lawyer standpoint. And I'll preface that by saying that approximately three-fourths of the people who come to our office seeking representation in a case against a doctor or hospital are ultimately turned away by our office after investigation on the basis that either there is not substantial merit in their case, or we cannot find a physician who will testify in their case, or that the case is unfortunately so small that it's not economically feasible for either the plaintiff or his attorney to represent him. And this is 3 out of 4. I sometimes think that the medical association should put us on a retainer for all the cases that we screen and keep from getting filed in court. I think that at least half of our time in the medical malpractice area is spent on cases where there is no claim made or no recovery made for the patient. When the client comes into the office, the first thing, of course, is to interview the client, and there is approximately 2 hours spent in an average interview. The lawyer then must start investigating the case, and this means obtaining copies of doctor's office records, which are sometimes extremely difficult to obtain, copies of the hospital records if the patient was in the hospital, which is frequently the case, and these are expensive to obtain, running about 50 cents a page, and sometimes you're talking about 300, 400, 500 pages of hospital records in some cases. And then after the lawyer has gathered all of this information, he must then spend a good deal of time on his own studying those records. He will either go up to the University of Oregon Medical School himself or retain somebody to go up there and do some medical research so that he has an understanding about what is involved in the case medically. He needs to become an expert in medicine as well as law. And when he has sufficient understanding that he can discuss the case intelligently with a physician, then he starts looking around for a doctor who is willing to consult with him on the case. And then, of course, the doctor must also review these records, and all of these things are expensive. At some place about this time, these three out of the four cases are washed out. If we believe that there is substantial merit to the patient's claim, the case is filed in court and depositions are taken of the defendant physician, the hospital personnel, perhaps the anesthesiologist, the assistant in the operating room. Sometimes there are multiple doctors on a case. All of these things are very time-consuming and also very expensive. You then set out, if you still believe that there is substantial merit to the case, in trying to find a doctor who will come into court and testify for that injured patient. And I'm sure that you've all heard of the term conspiracy of silence. I've thought that it's not a conspiracy, it's just a natural reluctance on the part of physicians to testify in a malpractice case. But I can tell you that in the last few months, since all of the turmoil has been going on in the media and the doctors have been faced with increasing insurance premiums, that at this particular time it is virtually impossible to find a physician who will commit himself to come into court and testify against another physician in a medical malpractice case. I've had doctors tell me, one very recently, on a case where he had told me that we have substantial merit in our case. He said, "You can take this case to court, Mr. Noble, and try it." And he says, "You will either win or lose. If I go to court and testify, I can only lose." And he refused to testify. This is becoming a greater problem right now than it has been in the past. Assuming that you can find a qualified and competent physician who is willing to go into court and testify for a patient against one of his colleagues, and you must have that testimony, the doctor is treated very fairly under the present court system. It is the exceptional case that does not require the testimony of another physician. The doctors are consistently represented by the best lawyers available, and there's nothing wrong with that. The doctors can, in every case, at least it has been my experience, find other physicians who will testify that this was really a medical mishap and not an act of negligence, regardless of how clear the negligence may be, because there are physicians who are so philosophically opposed to the idea of a lawyer suing a doctor or a patient suing a doctor that their objectivity is lost because of their underlying feelings on a malpractice case. Assuming you have testimony and the testimony comes into court, the case is of course tried to a jury. And jury, like all of us, hold doctors in high esteem we have what I think is almost a reverence for the medical profession. And perhaps for the first time in the juror's life, he is asked to question or challenge something that a doctor has done. And he thinks that perhaps if he holds the doctor responsible, maybe the doctor's going to lose his license or lose his status at the hospital. He's spent years in training. After all, he wasn't trying to hurt the patient. There's been some doctor that's come in and said whatever it was that he did, he didn't do anything wrong. And I can tell you that in a close case, at least, the jurors will give the doctor the benefit of a doubt. And I think that probably all of you have seen the statistics from Pownell, Taylor, and Hayes that were submitted to the House Judiciary Committee. And although the Oregon Medical Association and its insurance brokers are saying that the tort system has become punitive instead of compensatory, this insurance company, with its 1,500 or 1,600 doctors that it's insured in Oregon for the last 3.5 years, has never lost a case in the Oregon court. And so I submit that the tort system, as it now exists, and the jury trial as it now exists, and the requirement that a patient must have the testimony of a physician in order to have a chance to even have a jury consider his case, is protective of the physician, and that no changes are necessary in order to balance or rebalance rights against the patient in favor of the physician. The process of, or the approach to the problem of malpractice insurance by limiting the claims, in addition to being wrong, is probably not going to be successful. When you look at the batting average, and of course St. Paul, who insures about a third of the doctors, have lost a couple of cases. Kaiser, I know, has lost a few cases. Some hospitals have lost a few cases. But the overall batting average for the insurance companies is that they win the overwhelming majority of cases. And so if you pass some rule that outlaws res ipsa loquitur, or outlaws or removes from the doctor the obligation to obtain his patient's informed consent, you're going to have a very minimal effect on the number of cases where claims must be paid. In addition to never having lost a case in the Oregon court, the CNA Insurance Company has closed, according to their figures, 327 cases while they've been in business here. Of those 327 cases, they've closed 212 of them without any payment whatsoever to the claimant. In other words, they've only paid on one out of three claims in which they've settled. And so cutting back on the victim's rights or some of the rules of evidence is not going to solve the doctor's insurance premium problem. The other thing is that the limitation, I don't believe, is the answer either. If you look at the figures, you will see that most of the premium for malpractice insurance is paid in the first $100,000 worth of coverage. CNA offers coverage up to $5 million. After you cross the million or the $100,000 limit, the cost goes down rapidly. Our office retained an economist to go through the statistics and the information submitted by Pownell, Taylor, and Hayes and by CNA, and came to the conclusion that a limitation of $400,000 on the doctor's insurance, or on the claim, would save the doctor only about 10 or 11% of his malpractice insurance premium if he's carrying $1 million worth of insurance. And so that isn't going to save the doctors very much money. The second thing is that the limitation is of doubtful constitutionality, at least, and nobody knows what the Supreme Court will ultimately do with it, but no similar legislation has ever been passed before. It's different than no-fault auto insurance where the rights of the injured party to seek full compensation for his damage were taken away, but he was given in return sure compensation. Everybody that was injured in an automobile receives certain items of economic loss regardless of fault. And so where no-fault auto insurance limited the recovery, in some states it does, it still provides that the benefits are certain. And the courts of other states which have considered the constitutional question on no-fault and upheld it have looked to this trade-off or this quid pro quo where the victim loses something but he gains something, and overall it served a valid legislative purpose to pass the law. The same thing is true with workman's compensation, where the injured workman gets only a certain schedule of benefits, gives up his right to sue his employer for full compensation. But every injured workman receives those benefits. He's given up his right for full compensation, but has been assured of some compensation, regardless of fault, and that compensation will be paid promptly. No such provision is in the claims limitation provided in House Bill 2647. This limitation in this type of case should be distinguished from a limitation for wrongful death, which we used to have in Oregon, or a limitation on a claim against the state, which we still have. Because in both of those classifications of cases, there was no common law right to sue the state. There was no common law right to sue for wrongful death. And so when the legislature authorized the lawsuit, they could constitutionally place whatever limitations that they chose to place on the right to recover. And so those are some of the things that are going to have to be ironed out ultimately in the Supreme Court, and it may take years for it to reach the Supreme Court. In the meantime, if you'll consider the position of the individual physician who has on a statute that says he will only be liable up to a designated amount, say $400,000 that's in this bill, and he has in the past been carrying $1 million or $5 million worth of insurance, and he knows if he talks to a lawyer that there's a question about whether the bill is constitutional or not, what's that lawyer going to advise that doctor to do? And I'm sure that the careful lawyer and the careful doctor will come to the conclusion that the doctor's best policy, the safest thing for him to do, is to continue to carry the full maximum liability insurance that he's always carried. And if that is so, then the claim limitation has accomplished nothing. A third thing that I want to say about the limitation is that I doubt seriously that this limitation to, say, $400,000 makes the business any more attractive to the insurance industry. You'll see if you go over the figures that the gravy to the insurance company has been in the high excess insurance. CNA offers the basic policy of $100,000 and then an excess policy up to $1 million and then another one up to $2.5 million and another one up to $5 million. For the premiums that they have collected on all of their insurance in excess of $1 million, they have never paid a dime. And so if you place a limit at, say, $1 million, I don't see how this is going to make the business more attractive to the insurance industry, because all you've done is take from them the gravy in the insurance business and the premiums. It does not take much imagination to think of the individual whose injury is worth far more than $400,000. There's been talk of the 25-year-old workman who is earning $10,000 a year who is rendered totally disabled or killed as a result of medical malpractice, and that his lost income alone would exceed $500,000, not taking into consideration inflationary factors. The cost of hospital care is about $150 a day now for acute hospital care. A good nursing home is $1,000 a month. And if these things are going up at the rate of only 10% per year, they're going to double every 7 years. And so a limitation is grossly unfair. I have a client who's in town right now who's in the Salem Hospital having another operation. He was operated upon by a physician in the presence of an ongoing severe bladder infection. The infection spread and got into his bones, and after a series of about 16 operations, he ultimately lost both of his legs right at the groin, and he's this long. Before they took off his second leg, they said, if you don't have this operation and have the leg removed, you're going to die. And he says, fine, I don't want the operation. He looked forward to dying. They get him out of bed once a day and put him in a bucket, and the rest of the day he's in a nursing home or a hospital. And the cost of taking care of this boy for the rest of his life is probably going to exceed $1 million. His case would settle for substantially less money than that because there wasn't enough insurance. But a limitation such as this is going to be terribly unfair to some patients. And it's what it's doing. It's taking, in order to help solve the insurance problem, it's taking from the person most seriously injured and most devastated in order, hopefully, to reduce the cost of malpractice insurance. And I think that from a philosophical or humanitarian standpoint, it's just backwards. There are a couple of other provisions in the bill that I wanted to talk about. Section 9 deals with arbitration and authorizes the physician or hospital to enter into an agreement with the patient that any future disputes will be settled by arbitration. The statute does not have any provision in there about who the arbitrators might be or what rules of evidence would be followed, whether the arbitrators would be three physicians or whether they would be three lawyers or who they would be. And I assume that the doctor could write in anything that he chose to write in and have it upheld by the statute. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, from a public policy standpoint, that it is wrong to have a sick patient have to waive his rights to seek compensation under our present court system in order to obtain medical treatment from a doctor or hospital. I would think, and I submitted an amendment on this, that if the arbitration were restricted to the waiver of the right to sue were restricted to a time after the treatment is completed and the patient is aware of his injury and has knowledge of his claim, and if he wants then to arbitrate instead of going into court, that's fine. But I would argue against this section of the bill, which would authorize the doctor or hospital to obtain a waiver of these rights from his patient before the treatment is commenced. I think it's bad. Section 10 of the bill essentially codifies the existing doctrine of res ipsa loquitur, and I don't know if I can adequately explain the doctrine. If there's anyone that has any questions on it, I will attempt to. But Section 10 of the bill does nothing to change the present law. The thing that it does do is it fixes the present law. And I would recommend that that section not be passed for the reason that it takes from the court the power to decide when the doctrine should be applied and when it shouldn't be applied, and to make any modifications in the doctrine that may be necessary to fit the needs of a particular case. It just fixes it. And even though it fixes it at what is presently the law, it's therefore going to do nothing for the doctors, and it's going to limit the courts so that they have no discretion as to when it is or is not applied. based on a review of the circumstances of the particular case, and it gives the courts no opportunity to modify, either to expand or restrict the doctrine, as changing times or needs may indicate. I'd recommend that that section not be passed. Section 11 deals with the locality rule, and this, I submit, is unfair to the patient. The section, as it's now written, provides that a doctor will not be liable so long as he follows the standard of care ordinarily practiced by other physicians of his community or a similar community within the state of Oregon. And the change from the present law is the restriction within the state of Oregon. In some specialties, and I was looking through a booklet, Physician Manpower in Oregon, there are only 7 gastroenterologists in the state. There are only 3 doctors who specialize in infectious diseases in the state. There's a very limited number of proctologists, almost all of whom practice together. If, in a particular case, the patient is unable to go out of the state of Oregon to obtain expert medical testimony, then his rights under this section of the bill would just be lost. If he cannot find a doctor from the same community as the defendant or a similar community within the state of Oregon who will testify in court, then he has no case. And regardless of how meritorious it is, he'll have no opportunity to even have a jury consider his case. Under the present court-made law, a doctor from out of state may testify, but that doctor from out of state must be from a community which is, from a medical standpoint, similar with the community in which the cause of action arose, in which there is evidence that the standard of care as it relates to this particular case is the same, say, in Portland as it is in Vancouver, or in Salem as it is in Roseburg. These things must be established by evidence before the out-of-state physician can express his conclusion. This is, I submit, not unfair and not unreasonable. And I think that the only reason that this is in the bill is to hopefully cut down the patient's opportunity to find a witness who is legally qualified to testify in this case. I'd recommend that that section be defeated or not included in the bill. Section 12 deals with informed consent, and I don't really have any strong feeling on it. Essentially what they did was codify the existing case law on informed consent. Of course, this is the law that the doctors are objecting to, and this is what's been fixed in the statute. I've talked about the limitation of damages, and I would like to talk a little bit about the attorney fee limitation, which is contained in Section 13. In the first place, CNA's figures as given to the House Judiciary Committee by Pownell, Taylor, and Hayes indicated that in the 3.5 years that they've been in Oregon, they have paid out a total of $1.3 million in claims to patients. Assuming that most of those patients were represented by an attorney and the attorney charged them 25% of that recovery, this comes to a little over $300,000 being paid to the plaintiff's bar on medical malpractice cases over a 3.5 year period of time. This is $300,000 out of $6.5 million in insurance premiums, and it's only 5% of the premium dollar that's gone to the plaintiff's lawyer. I mean, it can't be looked at as the cause of the doctor's insurance premium problem. Secondly, the 327 closed claims, if you divide that into the amount paid to the claimant's lawyer, this comes out to less than $1,000 a case. And again, I say that this is argument valid argument that it isn't the plaintiff's lawyer's attorney's fee that is responsible for the doctor's insurance problem. Because these cases are so terribly time-consuming, because the lawyer must also become a doctor when he handles one of these cases, because of the sometimes absolute impossibility of finding a physician who will testify regardless of how meritorious the case is, and because of one other factor, which is that a lawyer who takes a medical malpractice case incurs the wrath of other physicians in the community, or of physicians in the community. Frequently, these are physicians whom that lawyer must rely upon in representing other clients on other types of personal injury cases. And I can tell you that in the smaller communities, it is virtually impossible now for an injured patient to find a lawyer in his own community who will represent him for these problems. Most lawyers in the state at this time will not handle the medical malpractice case for all of these problems that I've been talking about. And I'm concerned, although I don't think that the legislature needs to be concerned about the financial welfare of the attorneys, but I'm concerned that if the attorney fee becomes limited, that these people are going to have greater difficulty finding an attorney that will represent them in a lawsuit against the doctor. I have never had a client complain to me about a contingent fee contract. Usually, when the client comes into the office, that's one of the first questions that they ask is, are you willing to take the case on a contingent fee? Because this is a client that's already had huge medical expenses, or frequently substantial medical expenses, has had an injury with disability and time off of work, circumstances where it's impossible for him to hire a lawyer on an hourly basis. Most of us that handle malpractice cases would be delighted to handle them on an hourly basis if the client had the money to pay us on the same basis as they pay the defense lawyers. I think if you ask them questions, you'll find that much more of the premium dollar has been paid to the defense lawyers than has ever gone to the plaintiff's lawyers. And I think that this section is in the bill with the hope that if they limit the plaintiff's attorney fee, it'll be more difficult for the injured patient to find a lawyer, and therefore less claims will be made, regardless of whether they're meritorious or not. What I would suggest and throw in the hat on some a possible solution, I think first of all, we can all agree that it is absolutely essential that doctors have medical malpractice insurance available to them. It's a necessary element to the practice of medicine. It's got to be available. It's true, insurance companies have been pulling out, and the insurance carrier for the Oregon Medical Association may well pull out next year. There is included in House Bill 2647 a provision which would allow the doctors to become self-insured, set up their own insurance company, and would allow them to do this without raising the amount of money that's now necessary under existing insurance laws. Under the existing law, they would have to raise, I understand, several million dollars in capital to put in a reserve account before they would be qualified to do business under Oregon law. What this section of the bill does is it allows them to buy another insurance policy called aggregate insurance and substitute that insurance policy for their reserves. This would protect the patient as adequately as the reserves, and I would recommend that that be passed. Now, there is before this committee a separate bill, which I am told that there is a great deal of opposition to, and that's Senate Bill 578, the Insurance Commissioners Joint Underwriting Association bill, and I've been told it would be very difficult to pass that, particularly through the House of Representatives. What I'm suggesting is that that bill could be tailored to the doctor's self-insurance bill and that its effect be limited to the doctor's self-insurance company, and be limited to providing this aggregate insurance that we're talking about in the event that the aggregate insurance becomes commercially unavailable. I haven't talked to anybody in the insurance industry, but I understand that the approximately 400 casualty insurance companies in the state of Oregon who have no experience in medical malpractice don't want to be dragged into the medical malpractice field. They don't have adjusters, they don't have claims experience, they don't have expertise, they don't know how to handle the case, and they don't want to be in the business, and I can understand that. But what I'm suggesting is that if the Joint Underwriting Association bill were tailored to the self-insurance bill, where the only thing that this Joint Underwriting Association would do would be to provide this aggregate insurance that would never pay a claim unless the self-insurance company became insolvent, that this would then not require the average insurance company to be in claims management, investigation, and defense. They would just be there as a backstop in the event that the doctor's self-insurance fund became bankrupt or became insolvent. Another thing that maybe I call it, that maybe more of a gimmick than it is a program, but it might serve to alleviate some of the fears, is that if instead of a limitation on claims of, say, 400,000 or a million or whatever this committee may be considering, if you had a provision in the bill where any judgment in excess of a certain amount, say 250,000 or 400,000, whatever was deemed necessary, any judgment in excess of, say, 250,000 could be payable by the doctor's self-insurance company over on an annuity basis over the life expectancy of the plaintiff. This would do two things. Number one, it would alleviate or reduce the risk that the doctor's self-insurance company would become insolvent as a result of a single or a few large judgments or a bad claims experience in 1 year. They would never have to pay that $1 million judgment or that $2 million judgment that year. They could spread that loss over a number of years, so they wouldn't have the risk of going belly up as a result of the big judgment. The other thing that it would do is it would, if you get into the Joint Underwriting Association as an aggregate insurance carrier for the doctor's self-insurance plan, is it substantially reduces the risk that they will ever be called upon to pay a claim, because they would never pay a claim under what I'm suggesting unless the doctor's self-insurance company became insolvent. And so long as their actuarial projections and their premiums were in line with their claims experience, it would never occur. But if they got hit by a huge judgment, they would have the cushion or the further protection to spread that loss over a number of years, and this would make it even less likely that the Joint Underwriting Association would ever have to pay a dime. And the third thing that I would suggest that you could tailor into that, if it's politically necessary, is that you could put into that Joint Underwriting Association bill a provision that in the event that the Joint Underwriting Association paid out more in a claim than they took in premium, that they could have some type of an offset against the premium taxes. You could guarantee that they wouldn't lose a dime in the business. I think that if you would take the self-insurance bill and pass it, a limited Joint Underwriting Association bill and pass it, a provision on payment on an annuity basis for the large claim, that you will have solved the first problem, the biggest problem in the medical malpractice field, and that is that insurance is available. Secondly, I submit that this will ultimately result in a substantial reduction in the cost of malpractice insurance. CNA, having collected $6.4 million in Oregon over 3.5 years, has paid out in claims only $1.3 million. They've only paid out 20% of their premium has gone to the claimant. Now, they have future claims and reserves and things where more is going to have to be paid out. But there's nothing to indicate in their information that claims are getting more numerous or that the amount that they're paying off on each claim is going up. The Farmers Insurance Company has a subsidiary called Truck Insurance. They insure Kaiser, they insure a number of hospitals, and in connection with their hospital coverage, they also insure doctors who work at hospitals. I obtained from them their premium structure and found out that it is less, they are charging their doctors less than half as much as CNA is charging its doctors. The St. Paul Insurance Company, which now has this claims made policy, even when you add in the extra coverage that the doctor has to pay for the next 3 years, still is substantially less than CNA's insurance premium. The Oregon Bar Association, which has been insured by the same insurance company as the doctor, CNA, were notified about a month ago of a 300% premium increase for the lawyers in the face of practically nothing paid out in claims. And we were able to contact another insurance company and get insurance at a much lower rate. But what I'm suggesting is that there is substantial reason to believe that the insurance premiums being charged by CNA are unrealistically high and that they are not based on claims experience. And that a doctor's self-insurance company, which does base its premiums on claims experience, will save the doctors a substantial amount of money. That's all I have.
Questions? Okay, Senator Smith, Senator
Harden. Mr. Noble, what does your firm generally charge on a contingency fee on a personal injury such as we're talking about, malpractice?
We charge, I tell the client at the beginning that when they sign a contingency contract, which provides that if the case is settled without going to trial, we will take 1/4 of that settlement as our attorney fee, and if the case is tried, we'll charge 1/3. I can also tell you that at the conclusion of the case, that we look at the situation generally. Frequently, the cases are settled for a lot less than their full value. The client has substantial medical expenses, and it's not at all uncommon for us to discount the fee from that point on.
You mentioned that the settlement for the boy that has had both legs eliminated, taken off, amputated, was short as far as insurance was concerned. Did you take your full fee?
No, I did not.
You discounted it?
I did.
Would you favor a reduction in the statute of limitations, which now runs, as I recall, 10 years with a 4-year discovery for MDs?
The statute as it now exists is 2 years from the date that the injury is discovered or reasonably should have been discovered by the patient, up to a maximum of 5 years from the date of the negligent act. Now, there is a question. There is a question about a minor that has never been answered by the Oregon Supreme Court, whether or not a minor's claim can be extended for up to another 5 years. Another class of litigation, the statute of limitations does not run against a minor for a period of 5 years. It may be, but I can't say for sure because there aren't any cases directly on point, that a minor might potentially have 2 years from the date of discovery plus another 5 years, and so it might go up to 10. I've never seen such a case, but all cases must now be brought within 2 years of the date of discovery of the injury, which is 99% of the cases. up to a maximum of 5 years, with the question about whether a minor's rights are extended beyond that.
Well, you didn't answer my question. You clarified my statement.
Okay.
Now to the answer.
No. I am opposed to any further limitation on the statute of limitations. The doctors in California would, I was told by Representative Frohmeyer, would get down on the earth and kiss the ground if they could have the existing statute of limitations that we have in Oregon, because there it's just flat discovery and with no limitation. You have only a year from discovery, but no limitation.
What's the largest claim that you know of in Oregon on malpractice?
The largest settlement or judgment is a judgment of $500,000, which has not been paid, but that's the largest judgment.
Then why would you oppose any limitation such as you have on the settlement? You oppose the $400,000 limitation.
Yes.
Would you oppose a $500,000 limitation?
I'd oppose any limitation.
Why?
Because, for a number of reasons. Number one, I don't think it's going to do any good for the doctors or the insurance company.
You said it would reduce their, I think, 10 to 11%, you said, it would reduce the malpractice insurance.
There's only about 10 to 11% of the premium dollar that for the insurance between $400,000 and $1 million, which is about the average I think that most doctors carry. It's not going to save very much in premiums. I think, secondly, that until that limitation is tested by the Oregon Supreme Court, most doctors are going to continue to carry the high limits anyway. And the problem in getting the thing tested by the Supreme Court may take years, because it's going to take a case, I believe, where a plaintiff has gone to trial and gotten the full limitation, gotten the full $400,000 or whatever it is, and then appeals to the Supreme Court and said, I would have gotten more but for this limitation, and then the issue is before the Supreme Court whether the limitation is constitutional or not. Well, you look in the history of the state of Oregon, we've only had two judgments that have gone over $400,000 in the malpractice field. We may go another 10 years before we find the third one that would raise the constitutional issue. So what are the doctors going to do in the meantime? Now, it's true that it is obviously the rare case that has never yet occurred in this state where the patient gets more than that. But when you do have the deserving client that has the case where $1 million is necessary to compensate him, then he should get $1 million.
It's possible we'll have the ice age too.
Well, there have been other types of claims. There was a railroad crossing case down in Eugene where the judgment was for $1.1 million for a young man who was very seriously brain damaged. And I don't think that I know the lawyer that handled the case for the plaintiff. I haven't talked to the defense lawyer, but from the sounds of it, it sounded to me like that young man's damage is probably worth $1 million or greater.
Madam Chairman, just one more question and then I'll... If you were given the question, how would you react? If this bill were to provide that we would make the injured person economically whole with a cost of living increase, and the judgment would be given to him annually as was his previous wage, plus the fact that the attorney would be limited to a contingency fee of 1/4, would you support that?
No. You know, how a person can be very seriously damaged and have their life literally ruined without having suffered any significant economic loss. A child can lose an arm or a leg and have suffered essentially no economic loss and yet be devastated. A person may go through life suffering pain, may not be able to do the things in life that are important to him that make life worth living or meaningful to him, and have suffered no economic loss. Under the present law, on a malpractice case like any other type of case, a jury considers the effect of this injury on a particular individual and what is reasonable compensation for his injury. Economic loss is part of it. but that's only part of it. I think that any formula that tries to set up patients will get this, 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 and not get this, this, and this may be fair to some people and will be grossly unfair to others.
Would you favor any limitation on contingency fee?
I think not. I don't think that there is evidence that the contingency has been abused by the plaintiff's lawyer. I don't think that this committee will hear any evidence that the public or the patient and the client is dissatisfied with the contingency. You hear about $1 million judgment, you think, my gosh, if the lawyer charged 40%, that's $400,000, and that's too much, and it would offend me as much as it would anybody here. But I don't think if you started going through these a case-by-case basis, as I believe the Insurance Commissioner's Committee is going to do in the next year, that you're going to find that the plaintiff's lawyers have been gouging their clients with exorbitant attorney fees.
Well, what's the settlement for the boy who lost his life?
$250,000.
Okay. Go ahead.
Senator Howard.
You give Oregon rates on Oregon losses. And the insurance industry, as you know, we're in one of nationwide loss bases on these big companies like St. Paul and the rest of them. And I don't think that the insurance company has paid a hurricane loss in Oregon for years, maybe a little bit from Vancouver, I hate to get away. And we had a hurricane, what they might have called a hurricane, and no tornadoes that I know of. They're rated so that they cover the whole United States. We pay for those tornadoes that happened back then. We pay for hurricanes back then. You're giving them what they paid out in Oregon. But what about what they pay over nationwide? Have you thought to look at what they pay on a nationwide basis, St. Paul Fire and Marine?
Well, the only other state that I'm familiar with is the state of California, where the doctors have faced, you know, huge increases in their premiums, and Argonauts pulled out some of the doctors high and dry. But I've seen some of the figures that have been gathered on their claims experience versus premium income, and the ratio is about the same. They're not paying out as much in claims as they're taking in premiums, and yet they're jacking up the premiums. And that doesn't make common sense, I'll agree, but those are the facts. And I think, Senator, if through some of these studies that are going on, and by the way, some of the lawsuits that have been filed for conspiracy and antitrust violation against some of the malpractice insurance companies, that when the facts do come out, I suspect we may find that there has been a conspiracy, or that there has been a natural increase in premiums because of a lack of competition. But I don't.
Up until just a little bit ago, lawyers set fees too. The Supreme Court ruled that was illegal. Were you in there promoting that they do away with the set fees?
I didn't.
You're getting down to where the hair is short, you know. On who does what to who here.
I can tell you this. I didn't care much what the Bar Association did about changing the rules on whether this is a recommended fee or not.
That's reading a court case. If I was an attorney, I wouldn't either.
But
I
can tell you that in the past, there was some feeling that to charge less than the standard contingent fee was a form of advertising and was unethical for the lawyer. And that's no longer the situation, fortunately, and I think that the fees are probably down. I know that our office, we would sign people up on the standard contingent fee during that time, and then we would, at the end of the case, discount it consistently.
Now, if some of your attorneys got in trouble with big losses, would you be willing to pitch in and pay your share of the cost?
Yes. I can tell you that our office also handles a lot of workman's compensation cases where the deadlines for the statutes are very short, sometimes 60 days, sometimes 30 days. And we handle them on a large volume, and we have missed some of those deadlines. And when we do that, we advise the client and tell them to get a lawyer and bring a claim against us. So those clients come back to have us represent them on another case. And if a client, somebody walks into our office and they have a potential case against another lawyer that has merit, we'll handle that on the same basis as we would a medical malpractice case.
Well, I can understand that very well. And currently, I don't write malpractice because if somebody comes in and says, well, you let my policy expire, I have much choice to tell them to get an attorney because I can't do a thing with that. I can't do a thing. If my company won't do it, I can't do a thing with it. But I think that. Do you have your amendments drawn to this thing?
We have them in our possession. Yeah. Are there other questions of Mr. Noble? Thank you. I have three, I think I identified three more attorneys that we want to hear from, and I'd say to all three of you that I think Dick has done a good job covering the material, and so we'd like for you to not be repetitious, but we want to hear whatever you have to say about your position on the bill. We've been excused.
I carry four bills on this committee.
All right.
Will they notify the one?
I don't know. Maybe you'd better go down and check.
I'll check it over right
now. Okay, Mr. Griswold.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Jim Griswold. I'm an attorney. I practice in Portland. I'm with the firm of Green, Griswold, and Pippin in Portland, and we do plaintiff's work. Basically, we do plaintiff's work only. Our office has been engaged in the practice. Our office, as it goes back since 1920, always on the plaintiff's side. We handle all kinds of plaintiff's cases, not only the malpractice type that are involved here, but also drug cases, product liability cases, and we represent seamen and people on railroads as employees, as well as the automobile accidents, that type thing. I would like to make some comments here. I'll try not to repeat some of the things that Mr. Noble said. If I do repeat them, I would like you to assume that I'm trying to emphasize them rather than repeating them. The thing that I think this committee should know is that if we have, as a part of this bill as it's approved by the legislature in its final form, the contents of the recommendations. Number one, res ipsa here is not limited to the application in malpractice. This bill provides res ipsa to in any civil action for negligence. I'm not sure the committee is aware of that, but that was a mistake, or whether it was intentional, I don't know. But the bill as drawn would be for all kinds of civil actions for negligence, not just malpractice cases. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm saying that if we adopt through this or any bill the present court interpretations of res ipsa, if we adopt the present court decisions on expert testimony, if we adopt the present court decisions on informed consent and make them part of our statutes, we then nail ourselves down as to where we are today. There can be no development then, basically, in those fields of the law, those matters of evidence, except by action by the legislature. I really feel this is quite unwise. The expert testimony, the informed consent, I should mention, applies only to the doctors. It would not apply to anybody else. I think we are making a select group of the doctors if we pick and choose between the various court common law rules of law and evidence and set up a special set as far as the doctors are concerned. I really don't feel that it's going to make any difference at all with the present problem before this committee and before the legislature as far as the malpractice insurance coverage, its existence, and its rates are concerned. I would like to make some comments as to the limitations of recovery. One comment I think that has not been touched on is the effect upon settlements. Mr. Noble either looks at things more closely than I, or he has better clients come in. but I would think that in our office of malpractice matters that come in either against doctors or lawyers or accountants, whoever it might be, that after we have made our investigation and looked into them, probably 9 out of 10, we do not go any further. We don't have a 75% rate. I think we probably have a 90% rate that we have to tell the people, regardless of the amount of time that we've spent on it, that we can't help you. Now, of those that we feel we can help, including medical negligence cases, cases involving malpractice by lawyers or accountants, of those that are filed, probably 3 out of 4, if not more, are settled. And I think this is where the limitation or any limitation is going to become effective in the state of Oregon. If you have a case that has a value of $600,000 or $400,000 or whatever it might be for settlement purposes, if such a case exists, with a $400,000 limitation and knowing that the chances of winning are 50-50, although CNA apparently has not lost any, if you say there's a 50-50 chance of winning, the end result is that they'll not offer that $400,000. They'll say the most we can get stuck is for $400,000 or $500,000, whatever it might be. We have a 50% chance of winning, we'll offer you $200,000. We'll offer you $250,000, whatever it might be. I think this would be the biggest impact of that or any limitation in the bill. And when you realize that 75% or better of all cases filed are settled, of all kinds, for personal injury, you are then destroying the chances, basically, of settling any medical negligence case in the state. And when you look at the number of cases tried in Oregon, as to the number of cases disposed of, Mr. Noble gave you those figures, you can see that the settlement is the manner in which these matters are truly disposed of, not by trial, not one trial after another. Another thing on the amount, there have been some big figures talked about. The first hearing we heard of 12 $1 million or better verdicts in the state of California, which is one a month. This, for some reason, was expressed as terrible, unbelievable. I know nothing of what happened to those people down there. I do know that in Oregon there has been one verdict of $1,100,000. Burl Green, my partner, and Jim Pippin, my partner, obtained that verdict in Eugene against SP, against the railroad. I know that there has been...
That was an injury, not a malpractice.
That was a personal injury case, a railroad crossing case.
So the committee's clear that...
Yes.
That wasn't a malpractice.
No, the highest malpractice award or settlement I know of is $500,000, and I understand that has not been disposed of. Our case is still on appeal, the $1,000,001. There was a case that our office handled against BGE involving a man whose both hands were totally destroyed and he was in his late 40s. The jury verdict was $725,000. There have been about 3 or 4 other verdicts in the state that I know of where the injuries were serious enough that the jury felt that the plaintiff was entitled to $500,000 or more. These are $675,000 verdicts in that amount. Those cases exist in Oregon. They are exceptional cases, but they do exist. But if the limitation here is given to the doctors or to their malpractice carriers, you then are putting a top ceiling. You are putting a ceiling on the other kind of cases, the master-servant cases, railroad seamen, whatever it might be, because the same juries hear one case that hear the other. Your bill as provided doesn't make any provision as to what happens, as an example, on this attorney fee situation if a case is settled. What does happen on the attorney fee? What is intended? The bill doesn't tell us. And I think that it's a big opening, a big hole. Because if an attorney wanted to, he could not file his case and settle it on a contingent basis and there circumvent this bill, which would be totally improper. But it could be done. But the bill as passed by the House does not tell us what would happen as far as the settlement of a malpractice case is concerned, whether the court would set the fee on top of the settlement, whether it would come out of the settlement that is reached. If it came out of the settlement, if that be the intention, you are then instantly upon the settlement being made, turning the advocate, the attorney representing his client, he then has a conflict with his client immediately in front of the judge when it comes to the question of setting the fee. And I think this is an improper situation to put the court in, or the client, or the attorney. I don't know if it would be helpful to the court to talk about that thing in Eugene, because we seem to be talking about big amounts, big verdicts. They are the things that are scaring us. They're not in Oregon. This is the only one of any substantial size, really. We talk about the contingent fee. I know there's some questions to Mr. Noble about the contingency, whether it should be limited or done away with. As an example, that case was tried three times. It was tried once for 2 weeks with two lawyers there, and it was appealed and reversed on appeal. It was tried again for 2 weeks and resulted in a mistrial at the end of 2 weeks. It was tried the third time, and with two lawyers all three times, and after 2 weeks the verdict was rendered for $1,000,001, and it's on appeal again now. There are three offices of attorneys involved in that case. There's another office involved as far as briefs are concerned. So if you look at that and say $1,000,001, the fee is a third, or the fee is 40%, or whatever it might be, when you consider the tremendous amount of hours, there will be a substantial fee, but there was a substantial amount of time spent on it. But back of that, which I think is most important and hasn't been mentioned here, what about the five or six or seven other cases behind that that have been tried and lost with no compensation for the attorney? This is the purpose of our contingent fee arrangement, that without a situation such as this, the clients could not afford to hire attorneys and have their case tried, win, lose, or draw. And it isn't a $300,000 settlement with an attorney fee of $75,000 or $100,000, whatever it might be, that on the face of it is so grossly inequitable, that the attorney's grabbing too much of the doctor's malpractice insurance premium, too much of the money on that case. But you have to go back and look at the six or eight or ten other matters behind that where there was no recovery. And the attorney fee on the larger cases, the attorney fee on the successful cases, pays the attorney for the time that he spent on the cases where he is unsuccessful. I think that I could tie right in with the verdict in Eugene, regardless of what the fee might finally end up in that case. And I could tell the committee that Burl Green and myself went down to try a case involving a similar type injury. The man had serious, very serious head injuries, and he would never be employed again. He was in his young 40s. And we took 6 weeks trying the case, the two of us, and it was lost. And of course the client, because we were on a contingent fee, had no bill from us. In fact, we are appealing it. If we lose it on appeal, there'll be no attorney fee as far as we're concerned. But it is the successful cases that pay our fee for handling that kind of a matter. And that's why I feel when you combine these things together that it would be improper, that we would be undermining in this one particular field, medical negligence only, the whole foundation of the contingent fee arrangement in Oregon, which has not met with complaint up until this time. The railroads, as far as their employees under FELA, the steamship companies, as far as their seamen are concerned under the Jones Act, and when we did have the Oregon Forest Liability Law before 1966, when our workman's comp bill was passed, there was no complaint as to the attorney fee. I think I've hit, in addition, some of the high spots that I would like to present to the committee. I'll be glad to answer any questions that any of you might have.
While you're on the attorney's fees, is it possible that if this reasonable attorney's fees provision stayed in the bill, that your firm or others would take cases that you wouldn't ordinarily take on a contingency?
I think there would have to be a trial period. We would take them, yes. But if we then went to
one
judge...
Ones that you wouldn't take under contingency fees. That's what I want to know.
No.
Would you take cases that you wouldn't otherwise take under contingency fees?
Not at all. The way we handle the medical negligence cases is that we get all the facts we can in the form of the doctor's office notes, if at all possible. We get all the hospital records that we can. We talk with all the lay witnesses that we can, and that we find out what we can about the medical problems involved in that case, and then we go to somebody that we know and respect. And if he goes through that and he says, oh, good God, then we'll file a lawsuit. And we would do the same thing whether, regardless of which basis the fee would be on. But what I started to say, it would be on a trial basis. If we handle those matters, and they are complicated, they are time-consuming, and they are expensive. If we handled them and then found that some judge in Multnomah County or elsewhere setting the fee puts it on an hourly basis or puts it on a basis that is totally unrealistic, I fear we would then find that most attorneys would not be willing to handle a medical negligence case. I fear that might be some of the reason behind this.
Good. All right. Okay,
but
questions
as I
of Mr. Griswold.
I want to line with what Senator Roberts asked you. You think that there are attorneys out there, though, that would be taking these cases, the other attorneys that are specialized, like you've described your firm and like Mr. Noble described their activities, and specialized and do handle those cases. Others that may take the cases.
Take a $1,000 case hoping to get a $5,000 fee.
And then get more of those cases?
I would hope not, but I assume it could happen. But I would hope not. I would hope that the attorneys have something better to do than we do, and I think most busy attorneys do. I really don't. I would not want to admit that that could happen. I'll admit there's a possibility, but I'd hate to admit that that could happen.
Do you think it's likely to happen?
No, I don't think it's likely to happen. I really do not.
They can't afford it because of the cost of preparation. The gamble would be too great.
Well, I can't possibly see any court awarding on a $1,000 or a $5,000 claim for medical negligence a fee that would adequately compensate a lawyer for preparing and trying such a case, regardless of the outcome, really. Whether a person loses a toe through the negligence of a doctor or whether he loses a leg, I think that the preparation would be pretty much identical. The award would be substantially different. The lost toe cases are not handled, basically.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Ryan?
Yes.
Mr. Somers in the room.
Senator Roberts.
Where? Okay, you're next after Mr. Ryan.
Do you want me to defer to him?
No. You were here the other night. I'm taking
right back.
Well, I hope so. Our committee's...
I didn't mean to offend you, Senator.
I have other things to do.
Three of us are staying here, then they'll be in and
He's
out.
He's the only one in this committee that's heard me before.
The Senate is in session right now, and we're just holding forth here while they do their work.
I'm John Ryan. I'm a single practicing lawyer from Portland, Oregon. I had appeared on the on a previous committee hearing before the House on this matter because of my response to it. I do a general practice of law, and a good portion of my law is law work is plaintiff's work. As a personal injury attorney, my malpractice activity has not been high, although I have had malpractice cases over the years. I have also taught the law of torts at Northwestern and the law of conflicts of law, and more recently the course called Legal Remedies and Equity at Northwestern. I've been on the Board of Bar Governors and for 3 years for an elected term, and that's my general qualifications. I have principally come here today to talk and I about this bill. Well, two things. I wanted to maybe if it's no help to the committee, at least I'll get it off my mind. Principally, whether it's going to do the job that you're out to do. If we began with no opposition to it, recognizing that the doctors claim they are in a tough spot, and I feel they are to some degree, I realize how difficult for them it is to present a case to this legislative body about the economic effect upon the doctor of the malpractice situation, because that, first of all, calls for statistics. But I am sympathetic with their situation, and I want to talk just shortly about the constitutional question. Before I do that, as I say, I want to get something off my mind, because I'm not sure that as the attorneys speak here and as the newspapers have written up this particular problem, it has ever come out cleanly about the fee as one aspect of this case and about insurance as one aspect of this case of malpractice insurance. I think the record should be clear, and the lawyers on the committee, of course, would know that. Maybe the non-lawyers don't, because I find clients that don't know this, very, very well-versed people, that two things in a negligence case in the state of Oregon, and that goes for malpractice cases, that cannot go before a jury, or otherwise there would be a mistrial. Namely, you'd be thrown out of court and have to come back another day and start before another jury, is the lawyer's fee. That cannot be mentioned. And in the judge's instructions on damages, now maybe everybody knows this, but maybe they don't, but it's concerned me because there's been a lot of talk about this as a component in the cost of malpractice. In the judge's instructions on damages, of course, there's nothing about the plaintiff paying a fee. And the jury, in the eyes of the law, has no concern with that, and I would guess in many cases the jury has no real knowledge of how that fee is going to be assessed. Now, the fact of the matter is most of these cases are taken on a contingency basis, but has been pointed out, these cases could be tried for so much an hour or some other contract, and that would also be a contract to hire for a lawyer. So there, in the trial of these cases, the fee never comes up. If it came up, it'd be a mistrial. The lawyer that brought it up would be certainly censured by the court, but he'd be out of court and have to start all over again. So the fee. Now, the other thing that never comes up before a jury in our courts is the question of insurance. With the idea of giving some equality before the law, every defendant comes in there, and except where punitive damages are sought and the question of legal resources can become an issue, and that's sort of a lot. There is no, you cannot bring up the question of insurance. And the lawyer that did that or the client, there would be a mistrial. What we call a mistrial means the case is stopped and you have to start all over again with another jury. And there would be a censure to a lawyer who would permit the question of insurance to be entered. Now, I just said that because I'm not sure whether that fundamental has been rehearsed. I didn't see it in the press as it came up about attorney's fees contributing to this. I'm not going to put myself in the position, I will defend the fee or discuss the fee with anybody, but my primary reason for coming here was, can this bill get the job done? Now, I'm going to state what I think the job is, and I may misstate it because I'm not that close and familiar with this as some of these people that have put in much more time than I have. I heard the gentleman to my left from the medical people last time, and I know their real concern is, as I understand it, twofold. The most basic concern isn't just the question of how much they're going to pay for insurance, but will they have somebody to pay for insurance? I mean, will they have an insurance carrier of some kind to carry their insurance problem if they pay X premiums for it? Then the second one is that the cost of premiums will put them out of business. And that also has been proposed as a problem. The first, I understand, is the primary problem. The cost is secondary, but also is as strong. Now, will this bill do this job? Well, I've chosen to consider one part of it, and it's already been well done, so I'm not going to go too far on it. Is that as I see this bill, if I was talking to a doctor who came to me, and I have doctors as clients, and said, John, they passed that fine bill I read about in the Oregonian in the Journal, and what should I do now? Should I cut out my insurance except up to $400,000. Can I be confident in that limitation? And I would say, well, I went down there and listened to all those folks down there, and I heard that the highest judgment was $500,000, but there is the contingency that it might be higher, and each one of these judgments apparently rise and fall on the amount of damage done to the patient and the amount of responsibility of the doctor. So you can't tell how badly somebody would be damaged. And I'd say, I think you're going to have to wait a good long time to know whether that bill's going to hold water. Now, I'm not addressing the parts of the bill regarding the reciprocal insurance and the aggregate insurance. I'm very much in favor of that. I'm hopeful, and it's always nice to pass it on to you, that you come up with an insurance solution for the doctors, because they do have a problem. But I do not think that the $400,000 limitation amongst primarily would hold constitutional water. Now, I'm going to read two parts of the Oregon Constitution, and they're very short, and then I'll tell you what I think. One of them is the Equals Privileges and Immunities clause, which is Section 20, and I know you're familiar with it. I think I'm familiar with it, but I went back and read it. I have it in the case book here in case we have to re-quote it. But that fundamentally reads this way. Equal privileges and immunities of citizens. No law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities, which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens. Now, you got a tough job here if you're writing up a law to benefit, and you have to show there's a law like this that could be passed, perhaps, but I don't think it's this one, and I don't have the legal imagination to create the law to solve all the problems that are here. But when you set this limitation of $400,000 here, there isn't anything, as I read in this whole statute, the way it's drawn, that doesn't do anything but take away or limit the rights of the injured person. Whether it's the limit of $400,000 or everything that attends upon it. Now, naturally, I'm putting to the side the bill about insurance and some of the self-imposed restraints of on the medical profession in terms of discipline. But I think this really violates that law, that section of the code. Now, that's a constitutional. That's a constitutional demand which we're all sworn to uphold, and I don't feel that you can demonstrate here that there isn't a violation of that section of the Oregon Constitution. Now, there's another section, and I'll combine these, and which is Section 10, and it's about the administration of justice, but I won't quote it all because some of it I don't deem as applicable, but it reads this way: every man shall have remedy by due course of law for injury done him in his person, property, or reputation. Now, Mr. Noble has pointed out, and I'll just touch upon these, in the cases that have gone before us that might be the guidelines for this kind of a limitation, you have the workman's compensation law. Now, that abolished certain rights to sue by the workman, but it gave him back certain absolute rights for reparation. He had a substantial alternative remedy. So this law does not run the same course as the workman's compensation law. Now, you may summon up in your minds the Oregon Torts Claim Statute. Well, there was never any right for anybody to sue the state. Similarly, there was never any right for anybody to sue the United States. So when the Congress, in its way, passed the Federal Torts Claims Act, and this legislature put in Chapter 30 the Oregon Torts Claims Act, in both occasions they were the giver, not the taker. They gave the right of recovery against the state to the citizen who was harmed by the state or its agents in certain tort situations where he never had it before. Now, also in those acts, they wrote in situations involving attorney's fees, which I'll deal with separately. But essentially what I'm saying in both of those acts, in the Workman's Compensation Act, they gave something for what they took away from the workman. and there was a substantial social benefit. Now, I would have to tell my hypothetical doctor that this case has to go through the court mill, that this case has to be tested, and that I have my legitimate doubts of the constitutionality under the Oregon statutes, and we won't talk about the United States Constitution, I've got in too deep already, but I'd have to tell him that he better play his cards close to the vest for 2 to 3 years before he knows what his true exposure is. Now, then I'd have to add something to it. And I say, you know, another thing about that law, the way it was passed, is that I had here a quotation from a court that seemed to be a pretty good one. It's a Florida court on no fault. The test to be used in determining whether an act is violative of the due process clause, and that's what they mean by due course of law in that section 10 of our Oregon Constitution, is whether the statute bears a reasonable relation to a permissible legislative objective, that is one that is permissible or rightful, and is not discriminatory, arbitrary, or oppressive. All right, now in order to justify this before a court, seeing that this legislature had the right to pass this law, considering these due process and remedial rights in the Constitution, you'd have to ask some questions. Now those questions will have to be asked several years from now. They can't be answered here, but I wager that this $400,000 pulled out of the air as a terminal point for reparation for an injured person that got nothing back by this act whatsoever himself. He didn't get any sure payment. He didn't get anything back. I'd like to have anybody tell me why that wouldn't be considered, if not oppressive, and I won't go into that because that's got too many connotations, why that wouldn't be considered an arbitrary act. Now, this committee, of course, is searching for reasons. I heard Mr. Cook ask some economic questions the last time. I heard some other questions asked by Mr. Burbidge, by Senator Howard, by you, Madam Chairman, and others. But if they're going to be able to demonstrate a permissible legislative purpose, you got to get back to home base. And what I just said, is this going to do what it's supposed to do, what its objective is? If you pass this entire act, can you demonstrate that you had before you any proof that in taking away these rights from the injured person, you were in fact passing it as a whole? I can't pull part of it out and leave part of it in. I have to take it as the whole till I find otherwise. Can you demonstrate a permissible legislative purpose where you could stand up and say, yes, we know that if we pass that act, there will be insurance available for the doctors and that the doctors will not have the problem they are confronted with? I don't think that there is the evidence before this group that they will have the insurance and that this bill will obtain it. So I feel that you have real constitutional problems here. I'd have to tell that doctor, look, nothing's going to happen right away on this because nobody can be sure about this act. If it's all blown out 2 or 3 years, any insurer has to carry contingencies, and you'll have to carry contingencies to make up for that fact if you're the one doctor that may be subject to a higher judgment. I'd also have to say that I don't think there's any legislative standard been demonstrated where this act will solve a legislative problem. Because I understand what they're trying to do is try to solve something that is immediate, and I don't think it's going to gain its objectives. And I don't say that destructively to these people that are trying to solve a problem, but I did get this off my chest. I don't think it's going to hold up constitutionally. I think it's misleading the doctors. Seriously, and I think this is a bad situation too. It's misleading the doctors seriously that they're going to solve their problems with this kind of legislation. Because I don't think it's in the books to say that this legislation will be home safe for at least several years, maybe 3 years. And then I think there's a serious question, and nobody can say what a Supreme Court is going to do, predictably, but there's a serious argument against it on the basis that I've talked about, and I feel it sincerely. I'm open myself for questions.
Questions, Mr. Ryan? appreciate coming down, Mr. Ryan. Missed your short class by about 2 years. You left too soon.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Took mine from Bill Dale. Mr. Somers?
Thank you, Senator. Many of you, I know I'm Ron Somers, a lawyer from the Dalles, Oregon. I've been practicing there since 1962. I've had the experience of being on both sides of the fence on malpractice cases. However, I do not regularly defend them, and I do not regularly plaintiff in them. But I have some observations I'd like to impart to you. And I think that amidst the almost spectacular headlines that all of you have been reading and editorials that have come out on the subject, the question is, why is there a need for 2647, and why was it proposed? And who is it to protect? And I think ultimately the only answer you can give to that question is your elected constituents. And I think if you stop and think about that, there are 1,600 doctors in the state of Oregon to administer approximately the public health needs of the state. And the bulk of our citizenry is made up with the people who are subject to that limited group. And they have a problem. Now, there's two answers to the problem you can give them if you just come right out and say it. One, we could absolutely prohibit by some legislative fiat, which I don't believe would be constitutional, the bringing of any malpractice case. And two, a reasonable solution is to provide the doctors a method of insurance that they can live with, and at the same time a system of insurance that will be of a benefit to the people of the state. Now, some years ago, your predecessors decided, in all infinite wisdom, in addressing section 13 of the bill, that a life in the state of Oregon was worth $25,000. And it wasn't until 1967 that this body decided that a life was worth more than $25,000 and abolished the wrongful death limits. Every day, we're going to be subject to increasing medical costs, and that's an uncertain limit. And if you put a limit on the amount of recovery to take care of someone who is injured, you are not changing that limit, or you'd be subject to changing it at each legislative session. And we'd be right back eventually, I can see, in the situation we were in with the wrongful death limit. In the state, I have prepared a statement here on the House Bill 2647, and I don't propose to read it in detail, but just cover a couple of the highlights of it. I believe Senator Roberts has a copy of it.
I do.
And I'd like to...
I don't know if Senator Halleck shared it with all the other members or not, but we'll see if they get a copy.
Okay, if you would. I know the time is short. The problem we have here is that, according to the records, only 0.4% of the nation's total health care expenditures are presently on insurance premiums.
How much percentage?
0.4%. This is according to the President's Commission on Malpractice. But the one thing the commission did come up with is the inescapable fact that when malpractice claims are brought, the only reason they're brought is the fact that someone has been injured by a negligent act of a doctor. And the doctors themselves do not disagree that the infrequent case, that person should have redress. This state, I believe, shares an outstanding record of medical service. And I don't think we have the problems that many other communities have in dealing with the medical profession and them policing their own profession. But the federal government did set up, which the physicians are finding themselves limited with, at least in Medicare cases, a professional standards review organization. And each hospital in this state that wants to continue to receive Medicaid funds or Medicare funds has to have a peer review group in the hospital, and the doctors are all subject to the patients' records being reviewed by their peers. And they have found in many areas that this is a worthwhile program. I can say, representing some of the local doctors, that it would do well to perhaps strengthen the provisions of the bill to make those records absolutely confidential and the doctors given a greater immunity who sit on the board. And I don't believe you're covering that adequately in the first part of the bill here. Doctors, like lawyers, have a very high degree of responsibility towards not only the patients, but to the standards of their profession. However, many of them do not want to be faced with the situation, as occurred in Portland when they attempted to bring sanctions against one of the members of the profession, claiming that the allegations made against them were, in a sense, defamatory. And that problem rose in our local community, arising out of one of the cases that was brought before the peer review group. The other problem, dealing specifically with the bill, I know many of you have questions about Section 13 and the attorney's apparent interest in the goal. I've mentioned part of the problems with establishing a limit of $400,000. Mr. Griswold also brought out very saliently that when you fix the maximum limit that can be had on a case due to the highly technical nature of presenting a malpractice case, it would just encourage more litigation because no one would ever offer, in fact, the maximum limit that someone could recover. Even when you tender a case and admit liability, you can always gamble the jury is going to come in with a lesser sum. The other question that some of you were concerned with is whether or not there is any valid reason for the limiting the contingent fee provision of the present system of adjudication of malpractice claims. Senator Cook asked an interesting question. Would, in fact, the proposal of Section 13 of the bill, by adding attorney fees or allowing the court to set them, encourage the bringing of more malpractice suits? And let me tell you what an attorney goes through in making an assessment on some of these cases. Take this example of a woman who had received some surgery, and as a result of an improper application of stitches in that surgery, her occupation came from cleaning houses in the Dells. She was disabled, totally disabled, by a massive infection that was caused for a period of 14 months. That was her only source of income. Now, she could have provided or covered herself with the Social Security, but she has the 6-month waiting period. Now, given her meager income, which is approximately $3,200 a year, the question is, if you ask any doctor, they would say, obviously, she's entitled to recover. The treating physician just kept applying improperly antibiotics instead of going in and cleaning out the infected area and removing improper stitches, sutures. could you afford to undertake a case of that kind on a contingent fee basis? And it's very doubtful that a case of that size could be litigated, particularly in an area like the Dalles. Just to bring in another expert witness, I think you'd be talking about an expenditure, and I think Mr. Noble and the other attorneys here would concede the average cost, if you average it out on a malpractice case, of preparing them adequately for trial and bringing in the appropriate expert witnesses would exceed the amount of her recovery. Now, I don't think removing the contingent fee system is going to help her in that case, and I don't particularly think your substituted system would help her either. The question is, most judges in the state of Oregon are not presently practicing law and have not practiced law and have no realistic idea of what the cost of practicing law is in today's market, and probably would be very remiss to award adequate fees to cover those situations. I think the answer, in short, without going through the details that I presented to you in the paper concerning what the actual coverage is for the doctors, is that there is no justification for the insurance company asking for a 162% increase in premiums. They do not have a corresponding loss ratio. The Argonaut Insurance Company reported, and these facts are reported in the Wall Street Journal and not in this document I have, that they suffered over $100 million loss in 1974. That's what their report was. And if you look to their report to the stockholders, their parent company, which is the Teledyne Corporation, even suffering that loss, they could pay a $10.8 million dividend. And that was sought as a reason for abandoning the New York market, their losses. Most of the losses that have occurred for the insurance companies, and this was particularly true in the Hawaiian Insurance Company, and one of the reasons why they reportedly dropping what coverage they had in Oregon, is losses suffered not by malpractice claims, but by rather disastrous investments in their reserve funds. And I think Mr. Rawls is here in the room. He could back up what some of the problems are that the insurance company's gone through. My opinion is that if you wanted to turn a bill out, and I think in order to help these people through the situation, it's incumbent on you to bring forth a bill that would help them, and your days are limited, I think the answer is to either A, strengthen the provisions of 2647 after you eliminate Section 13, and after you eliminate Section 11, which I'm just going to lightly touch on. I would tell you this, that if you literally interpret the provisions of Section 11 of the bill, where you hold them to the standards of practice of ordinarily careful physicians under the same or similar circumstances in a same or similar community in the state of Oregon, if that were to be liberally interpreted, you'd give a free ride to everybody east of the mountains. Because you take a look at some of the communities over there and try to balance them out population-wise. Look at the town of John Day, for example. The doctors pop in and out of there regularly. What do you do in the terms of health care standards in the community of Fossil? And where would you find a corresponding physician? What would you do, say, for example, in the town of Condon, where you have one doctor? And he only practices part-time. Where would you find a similar circumstance in the state of Oregon to judge his standard of care? And if he goes off the track, who judges his standard of care? I think it's a fatal defect in the bill. Many of the malpractice claims that arise for two reasons. One, there was obviously an injury, and two, somebody told that person they had a cause of action. And I would suggest to you that person who suggests that to the individual is someone in the medical community. It's either a person on the staff of the hospital or it's another doctor, because the attorneys do not and cannot go about the state soliciting malpractice claims. To do so would terminate your right to practice law immediately, if not sooner. In answer to the bill, I would like to suggest that you offer the physicians of the state and the medical community the assistance they so badly need by helping them write another success story as they have written for themselves with the Oregon's Physician Service, a self-insurance organization. That has helped many people throughout the state, formed by Oregon physicians, to provide health care facilities and payment for those services. And I believe, with slight assistance from the state, the doctors could write their own malpractice policies. And the Oregon Association of the, could establish their own malpractice group. The problem that you're going to have, and I think it's partially covered in the Senate bill and Mr. Noble's amendments, I think will bring it forth to you, is that you need some seed money to get it started, and that money could easily be borrowed from the State Industrial Accident Fund. They have almost a $200 million surplus there, and if you authorize the lending of that money to them at a reasonable rate to get their backing to get started with, I think they could all substantially reduce their experience. And who would ultimately benefit? A, the doctors could share lower rates, and it's not a state-run program. They own the program themselves. And two, if the claims seem to be getting out of hand, their own governing board, who would have the authority to write the policy, could then look more stringently at those defaulting doctors. Thank you for your time. Are there any questions?
Questions to Mr. Summers. Appreciate you coming all the way.
Thanks.
To we have two doctors and John Olson who want to testify, and I'd like to get through those three. Last Monday night was sort of doctor's night, but since two have signed up, we'll be happy to hear from them. Dr. Bailey? This committee does reconvene at 7 o'clock tonight, you know. We'll hear Lester, you be here tonight? I'd like to put you on first. We get through these three witnesses this afternoon. I think we've got lots of questions to ask.
I feel like I've got four tough acts to follow, and I'm used to dealing on a one-to-one basis with a patient and not speaking in front of a crowd. But my name is Cass Bailey. I'm a physician here in Salem. I'm an anesthesiologist, and I feel like a person who's about to become extinct. My insurance runs one more year, and hopefully something that is done in this legislature will permit the insurance companies to continue to insure anesthesiologists in the forthcoming years. Right now, to make one of the comments that Mr. Noble brought up, he said he mentioned several insurance companies compared the rates. They're much lower than CNAs. The other insurance companies don't insure anesthesiologists. That's why they're lower. They don't insure neurosurgeons. They don't insure orthopedic surgeons. And these are the high-risk groups. St. Paul, which had covered people here right along, is now dropping all of anesthesiology groups. Mr. Ryan made a comment that will this bill get the job done? I'm not sure that it will, but at least it's a start in that direction, and we have to feel like we have to have some kind of movement towards an answer to this problem. I spent 2 weeks in California in the Oakland and San Francisco areas, and the people there are really feel like they're backed out into the bay. They just have no place to go. Their insurance rates are continuing to go up. They're charging fantastically high fees to the patient to cover these rates, the practice of anesthesia, when I came to Salem in 1966, I paid $136 a year. As of the 1st of July, I will pay $12,000 a year. The comments about large cars, big homes, thick carpets, we don't have any of those, unfortunately. Maybe I'm a poor businessman. Maybe my corporation doesn't run things well. But I do know what I have as an income from my business. I do know what I have as an outgo for my expenses to run that business. And I really feel that we're into a bind here where certainly we feel that we're being put upon by not being able to get our insurance or having their premiums continually increased. But it's the patient, the very person that we're all into medicine to help, is the one that really has to bear the cost. People who are on welfare can't pay it. The welfare institution itself doesn't pay enough to cover what is now going to be the increased cost in premium. The people who are on a fixed income certainly have no way to pay this. People who are on Medicare is always behind. They cannot pay this. It ends up falling then to a limited number of people who have to carry this burden. I think that as we go on through this, maybe some solution will come up. But certainly I think we can't just say, well, this bill is bad. There are many factors here that are not good. There are a lot of things that probably maybe a year or two down the road will be changed. But certainly I think we have to start someplace. And I am concerned about the practice. I'm concerned enough that I've made preparation for next year in case I can't get insurance to take my care. I imagine there'll be a large number of anesthesiologists that would return to primary care. But then this brings the operating room to a standstill. If we can't get insurance next year, there won't be any question of a strike. I don't think, in talking to anesthesiologists, that we want to take the route that the people are having to do in California. But if we can't get insurance next year, or if the rates become so high that we can't afford them, then we can't practice. Now, maybe in a sense that's a strike, but that's where we feel that we're being backed into that corner.
Questions are Dr. Bittman.
What was your gross income from services last year?
$55,000.
And what was your income after payment of your expenses of doing business?
My payment to myself was $38,000.
And what was the other $17,000 paid for?
$17,000, $12,000. I'm going to give these to you in round figures now. $12,000 to $13,000 went for taxes. I can't recall how much went for my office practice itself. It seems to me that that would be something in the range of about $5,000 for my office overhead.
$5,000 for your office?
I think so.
What about how much did you pay in insurance? Did you include insurance in these figures?
That was included in that. My insurance last year was $3,000. It was just under $4,000.
Who paid? Didn't you have any office help that had paid?
No.
Didn't pay any office?
No. That's one of the nice things about anesthesia. We are hat in hand, I guess. That's our office.
And so basically, then your gross income before taxes is $50,000. Did I get it right? You paid.
Well, it's. I think it was around $55,000 is what my gross receipts were.
Let's see, $38,000 you paid to yourself, $12,000 you paid in taxes. Is that income taxes?
Income tax.
All right, so if you figured it like I do, I figured out what I have after paying my overhead. I'd have had $50,000. Right? You paid $12,000 of that $50,000 in taxes. Is that correct? Actually, your income after expenses was $50,000.
You're wrong. The money I had.
Before tax. Income before you paid your income tax.
The money I took home for myself and my family was about $36,000.
Did you you have to pay taxes out of that $36,000?
No, the taxes are paid in addition.
All right, so then your income before the payment of income taxes was $50,000.
Well, you've got your answer about what.
Yeah, okay. I think the figures I gave you were wrong. I'm not here to talk about what my income and things like that are. Only in that, if it answers a question, that's fine. But my gross income was about $55,000. My in taxes were in the range of $12,000 to $13,000. My office expenses were in the range of $5,000. My travel expenses, I have to keep up a certain amount of refresher course training. That required an X number of dollars, and I'm sorry, I don't know how much that is. What I took home from that then goes for my home expenses and my insurances, which I have to pay a little bit more maybe than the average person for health insurance.
What was your insurance premium last year for malpractice?
I paid $931 a quarter.
$931 a quarter.
Yes. As of the 1st of July, I will go to $3,000 a quarter.
How many cases did you handle in 1974? Bobby, how many individuals?
That was approximately 800 cases, of which I think people that could either pay in part or all of their bill would figure out to about 675 cases.
675. You paid about $3,600 last year then in insurance. You said 900 a quarter.
But now I'm one person, and you can't. I hope you're not going to look at this bill as a one person thing.
What I'm trying to get at is if I were grossing $100,000 a year from my individual practice as a lawyer, then $5,000 a year or even $10,000 a year wouldn't necessarily be a large item.
That's right, but I'm
so
not.
$12,000 or your premium is significant, primarily as it relates to your gross. That's one of the things that determines whether the premium is out of line or in line. I think it's one of the things. You can't look at the premium without looking at.
No, that's not your problem. You're all right.
Well, unfortunately, I don't gross $100,000. I gross this amount. This is a variable amount. It varies on the number of people who are able to pay the increased fees. And I know what my expenses are. And I do know that with the increase in premium and increasing my rates, that I will be able to pay those rates. But next time around, I don't know what happens. How do the patients tolerate the next increase in rates?
But isn't the fact, or probably a fact, that there are a limited number of people in your specialty in this state, correct?
In this specialty, yes.
All right, and so, a little as we might like it, as a practical matter, there are limited numbers, and you're all going to be assessed presumably the same premium. So, as it may be bad, but as a matter of fact, you'll be able to pick up the difference in your insurance by passing it on to your patient.
And is that fair?
Because they have no choice.
That's
well,
right.
That's,
is that fair
that's
to the patient?
The
that's. I'm. Well, no, that's not the cost
of
business.
What I'm saying is, it's not going to put you out of business because you are in a position where you are because you are in limited numbers and you have all by the insurance from the same company. You will be able to pass it on. So we should judge it on that. That's another question.
We don't all buy our insurance from the same company, unfortunately. Now, maybe if we did, maybe we will have to down the road. But the thing is that we're here, and you folks are here, I hope, to do something for the people. And these are the things that we're trying to keep our costs down to them. If we can lower the cost of the malpractice rates, then I am going to cut my rates back to what they were prior to any increase. It's maybe a small thing, but it's something that at least that I feel that I'm doing for the people that I started out in this profession to help.
Dr. Bailey, we appreciate your time. You come. Thank you very much. Dr. Clappison, I think as you're coming up, come ahead. I think there was an item of business to be taken up by the committee at approximately 5 o'clock. Does anyone have a motion to make for Mr. Aaronson?
No,
they don't. But you tell me these things, Bill. I thought we were on. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Dark.
Senator Roberts and members of the committee. I'm going to try to make this very brief because I think we're about ready to adjourn, and although I'm last man up as well.
No, we
as
have
out.
One more after you, so we do appreciate the privilege.
I would like to speak briefly about a problem that's kind of interesting, and if I can digress for just a minute on a matter of historical interest. We moved recently, and in going through some of my old papers, I found my first professional liability policy from DeWitt, Iowa, and the premium was $19 per annum. That was in 1952 to 1953. I think this is interesting. Admittedly, this was general practice, and admittedly, my limits of liability were a lot less than I now carry. I now feel that $1 million is the minimum, and I'm thinking seriously of increasing my limits to $2.5 million for protection. However, I'd prefer not to talk about economics so much as about patient care, and I have about four items that I'd like to mention very briefly on this. First of all, and these are things that I'm familiar with personally here in Salem. Many of you probably know Dr. Thad Moreland, who is senior anesthesiologist in this community and who worked part-time for a number of years and was of great value to us for vacation relief, bench strength, so to speak, and who not too long ago retired completely because he could no longer afford the liability premiums on a part-time practice basis. I don't think very many people in my specialty, which is among the highest, can do so. This means that either you practice full-time or you don't practice. The next one is the increased cost to patients, and many people have already raised their fees at least 10% to take care of the increased cost of professional liability, which took place starting the 1st of May. You're familiar with this. The third thing I would like to mention is the loss of any insurance. We have two men in town who are faced with this problem this winter. Dr. Charles Gray, who's second senior anesthesiologist in the community, after 26 years of carrying almost all of his insurance with St. Paul Mercury, he was informed that he could not renew at any price as of his annual renewal date. Dr. DeSanko was faced with this same problem. Fortunately, the State Society program, CNA, took them both on, or we would have lost two men who were still insured with St. Paul Mercury at that time. I think probably most of the committee is familiar with problems in other states, particularly California, and the efforts in some of these states, legislation-wise, to solve similar problems. I won't burden you with those except to mention briefly that Florida and Indiana have already passed liability limit laws and other features that should alleviate the situation as far as these states are concerned. I'd like to rebut briefly some of the things that one of my predecessors mentioned. In regard to the 400,000 limitation, his figures are a little different than mine, I think. As I figure it, the difference between what I would pay for a 400,000 limit and what I would pay for a 5 million limit is something closer to 20% than 10%. And I've already mentioned the fact that St. Paul claims made type policies may be cheaper, but they're not available to us. If any of you have any questions that I could answer.
What was
your insurance premium for 1974?
My insurance premium was the same as, nearly the same as Dr. Bailey's. I have it jotted down here as $3,880.
What was your gross income?
Madam Chairman, I'm disturbed about this line of questioning. I suggest that the doctor be given the opportunity to answer the question or not. I don't think it behooves it to answer it. I don't see it as a point of anything. I'm a little bit embarrassed about asking and listening to this line of questioning.
Madam Chairman, it seems to me that they've come in here, they set forth their premium, and as I think any business person, the premium or cost of doing business is not relevant unless you know what kind of a gross they're talking about.
I think, Senator Cook, you could ask every single doctor the same question and get a different answer.
Right. In fact, they each would have different...
In the entire state, because they're each going to have a different income.
That's true. And I'm interested in what the income, what the insurance premium is in relation to the growth of the business of practicing medicine. I don't see anything improper about that.
I'm willing to answer the question. My new premiums will amount to about 20% of my gross. I averaged my gross for the last 3 years, and the new premiums will amount to approximately 20% of my gross.
Of your gross in the past or the new premiums? Well, your new premiums will be $12,000?
Approximately.
Okay, so you're saying your income was about $60,000 a year?
My gross income.
Okay. Now, what part of that was paid out for goods and services? What I'm trying to make the distinction is this gross income before the payment of taxes and after the expense of doing business?
No, this was total gross income.
Okay. And your cost of doing business, did it exceed 20%?
Yes, it did. The cost of my premiums will have gone up by the percentage you have there. I figure that my new cost of business will be somewhere between 30% and 35%. Our costs are somewhat less than the man who has an office to support because we employ a billing service which takes a flat 6% off the top of that gross that I previously mentioned.
You're an anesthesiologist?
This is
Senator Cook, we have one more witness, and I think maybe you might talk with him privately if you want to get any further information.
I do have some figures here from the latest medical economics. I believe Senator Roberts expressed an interest in recent figures, which I would like to just give to you.
Right.
This is our last issue, the most recent issue I have, and it does point up some averages that might prove of some interest. This
okay.
is the reason why all doctors, not just anesthesiologists. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Senator Cook, because it has an average, median, and that sort of thing of income. Thank you. Appreciate your time. John Olson, this is our last witness until we break up for 7 tonight.
I'm John Olson of the Longshoremen's Union, so I'm not representing doctors, lawyers, or insurance companies. But I could throw in a real emotional appeal, as my wife was cared for by a fine GP who was way over his head as she was in a respirator with a tracheotomy. Another neurologist, I called a friend at Lewis and Clark, Dr. Faw, and he said, even you, as poor a student as you were, should know that isn't psychological. And another doctor came to the hospital while she was strangling and diagnosed the case in a few minutes and gave her a shot, and we got her out of the respirator and took her home. Of course, the case was terminal, and I didn't sue for $25,000 because he's a great guy. He's just a general practitioner still practicing in Washington County who was way over his head, but he's a fine guy and I like him. But my opposition to this bill is that the legislature should not pass Senate bill, House Bill 2647, because the passage of this bill would result in nothing but harm to the average individual who attempts to be compensated for injury caused by a physician's negligence. The average citizen should not be penalized by a group of professionals who are seeking a limited degree of responsibility for their negligent acts. By passage of this bill, the legislature would be making the medical profession a group apart from the rest of society, granting them privileges that no other segment of society is allowed. If the legislature grants the medical profession such immunity, other professionals such as attorneys, accountants, stockbrokers, and a host of others will also seek immunity, maybe even longshoremen. I notice Senator Packwood hasn't introduced a bill yet to settle the strike in California, but he was quick to when the longshoremen were on strike. The ultimate result will be that anyone who is a professional could commit negligence without being held fully accountable. It's difficult to decide what an injured individual should be entitled to receive as damages. However, the problem is not made easier by writing limits into the law. It's better to leave these decisions to the courts and juries to decide the evidence they hear. For instance, how can you tell a working man who is rendered a quadriplegic he'll have to support his family and pay his medical bills the remainder of his life with $400,000 when the current rate of a medical bed for such an individual is about $150 a day? The general public should be not made to pay the price of physicians' errors. It's true that something may be done to alleviate the malpractice problem, but punishing the injured party cannot be the solution. If stricter controls are needed on the insurance industry or the medical profession, then investigate these possibilities, but let the injured party realize adequate compensation for his injury. As welfare officer of my local, I found it's virtually impossible to find an attorney to take these cases. And it's impossible to prove these cases. I have a granddaughter now who's receiving medical care under one physician who will not be accepted by any other physician in the city of Portland because she's receiving this care, which I deem inadequate, from another physician. And this, again, of course, is an orthopedic physician that I've just learned today that their rate, their premiums are unreasonably high. I've negotiated with insurance companies a number of times through weekly indemnity plans for my local. In fact, they doubled our rates one time. And if this costs are being projected throughout the whole United States, it was interesting to me to go to another city and find these huge, huge hotels and buildings being built by the same insurance company that couldn't afford us anymore because we had a couple people who drew weekly indemnity. Today in the Oregonian, perhaps you noticed, perhaps you didn't, being busy down here, and I got home from clam digging, so I got a chance to read it myself, that the doctors in New York find the new insurance law that they just passed, the new medical malpractice law, so unpalatable that they can't live with it. So, June 15th, they're going to obtain a state license and raise $40 million through issuance of capitalization fees or shares at $17.50 per doctor and carry their own insurance. Though the legislature in New York agonized, much as our legislature is, over what to do about this problem. And it really is a problem. This legislature in New York, after passing a law that they thought would relieve it, found that the doctors couldn't live with it, so they are solving it through their own efforts. After a demonstration by 500 surgeons, they got together and decided that maybe they ought to insure themselves. The malpractice question, one critic of the current state legislation, and this is speaking of the Indiana legislation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, was the director of the 1971 Health, Education, and Welfare Secretary's Commission report on medical malpractice. The time has come for all parties seeking solutions to the malpractice problem to recognize that the root cause of the current malpractice problem is the substantial number of injuries and other adverse results sustained by patients during the course of hospital and medical treatment. That was a Dr. Burnswick. Of course, the Nader-sponsored group, which I don't know whether it'd find favor here or not, says, rather than being an isolated crisis, the malpractice dilemma is just one more symptom of the American health care crisis. And I'm not suggesting that we correct it the way that the province of Vancouver, B.C. has, which is working, it's a somewhat of a dirty socialist scheme under their medical plans, but theirs is working beautifully. And they thought the insuring of it was of such prime importance and that medical care was so important to their people that they've undertaken to underwrite the whole thing through taxes, of course. I'm not suggesting this, but they certainly have solved it and are considering throwing in dental care right now for all the children from age 5 to 15. I certainly hope someday we look to that solution. But to sum it all up, we certainly appreciate and enjoy fine medical care here in Oregon, and we certainly want to see it continue, but not to the detriment of injured people through malpractice, and not to the detriment of other people who are earning a living, making them completely exonerable from any acts.
Mr. Olson, you're representing yourself or the union today?
I'm representing my union today. In fact, I wouldn't have came back from clam digging if my counsel hadn't have been concerned about the malpractice laws.
Okay, Senator Howard.
Well, I think that we better look a little bit about who owns the buildings around. Standard Insurance in Portland, they don't write anything with life insurance. They own the Standard Insurance building. I have a policy with them, and that they have to never pay it back. That's where my life insurance money is invested. I have defaulted the insurance company for years for not doing a public relations deal on it. But if the buildings that are owned around the country are owned by life insurance that's invested, not these kind of companies, State Hall Fire and Marine, life insurance is invested. That's the way, just like the state of Oregon, they invest money. The capital, the state officer, they're investing money. Just to make it, own it. That's where our life insurance money is invested all over the United States.
I understand this is separate and apart from the other insurance senator. I just wish that all of their profits from all their diversity, like other multinationals, was all lumped together in one.
You look and check about, they don't have anything to do with this bill at all.
Got a call on? All right, dismissed. Okay, thank we just, what is it?
30-30.
Yeah, but
voluntary pledge to the one treasure concept.
Oh, okay.
We don't want to vote today.
Where is it?
Thank
you.
We'll have to go down for the call of the Senate. Tonight, we're going to hear from a representative of the nurses. We're going to hear from Lesterol about what it takes to set up this insurance company for the doctors, and then we're going to get down to work on the bill. So we'll all be here.